The Audio Partners Publishing Corporation is pleased to present The Lessons of History by Will and Ariel Durant. This is published by arrangement with Monica Ariel Mile, trustee of the Ethel B. Durant Trust, Monica Ariel Mile, and William James Durant Easton. Copyright 1968 by Will and Ariel Durant.
This reading of The Lessons of History is complete and unabridged, with slight modifications made for the understanding of the listener. Preface from Will and Ariel Durant. This postlude needs little preface. After finishing The Story of Civilization to 1789, we reread the 10 volumes with a view to issuing a revised edition that would correct many errors of omission, fact, or print. In that process, we made note of events and comments that might illuminate present affairs, future probabilities, the nature of man, and the conduct of states. The references in the text to various volumes of the story are offered not as authorities, but as instances or elucidations so come upon. We tried to defer our conclusions until we had completed our survey of the narrative. But doubtless our preformed opinions influenced our selection of illustrative material. The following essay is the result. It repeats many ideas that we or others before us have already expressed. Our aim is not originality, but inclusiveness. We offer a survey of human experience, not a personal revelation. Here, as so often in the past, we must gratefully acknowledge the help and counsel given us by our daughter, Ethel. Chapter 1. Hesitations. As his studies come to a close, the historian faces the challenge, of what use have your studies been? Have you found in your work only the amusement of recounting the rise and fall of nations and ideas, and retelling sad stories of the death of kings? Have you learned more about human nature than the man on the street can learn, without so much as opening a book? Have you derived from history any illumination of our present condition, any guidance for our judgments and policies, any guard against the rebuffs of surprise or the vicissitudes of change? Have you found such regularities in the sequence of past events that you can predict the future actions of mankind or the fate of states? Is it possible that, after all, history has no sense, that it teaches us nothing, and that the immense past was only the weary rehearsal of the mistakes that the future is destined to make on a larger stage and scale? At times, we feel so, and a multitude of doubts assail our enterprise. To begin with, do we really know what the past was, what actually happened? Or is history a fable, not quite agreed upon? Our knowledge of any past event is always incomplete, probably inaccurate, beclouded by ambivalent evidence and biased historians, and perhaps distorted by our own patriotic or religious partisanship. Most history is guessing, and the rest is prejudice. Even the historian who thinks to rise above partiality for his country, race, creed, or class betrays his secret predilection in his choice of materials and in the nuances of his adjectives. The historian always oversimplifies and hastily selects a manageable minority of facts and faces out of a crowd of souls and events whose multitudinous complexity he can never quite embrace or comprehend. Again, our conclusions from the past to the future are made more hazardous than ever by the acceleration of change. In 1909, Charles Peguy thought that, quote, the world changed less since Jesus Christ than in the last 30 years, end quote. And perhaps some young doctor of philosophy and physics would now add that his science has changed more since 1909 than in all recorded time before. Every year, sometimes in war, every month, some new invention, method, or situation compels a fresh adjustment of behavior and ideas. Furthermore, an element of chance, perhaps of freedom, seems to enter into the conduct of metals and men. We are no longer confident that atoms, much less organisms, will respond in the future as we think they have responded in the past. The electrons, like Cowper's God, move in mysterious ways their wonders to perform. And some quirk of character or circumstance may upset natural equations, as when Alexander drank himself to death and let his new empire fall apart, 323 BC, or as when Frederick the Great was saved from disaster by the accession of a czar infatuated with Prussian ways, 1762. Obviously, historiography cannot be a science. It can only be an industry, an art, and a philosophy. An industry by ferreting out the facts, an art by establishing a meaningful order in the chaos of materials, a philosophy by seeking perspective and enlightenment. The present is the past rolled up for action, and the past is the present unrolled for understanding, or so we believe and hope. In philosophy, we try to see the part in the light of the whole. In the philosophy of history, we try to see this moment in the light of the past. We know that in both cases, this is a counsel of perfection. Total perspective is an optical illusion. We do not know the whole of man's history. There were probably many civilizations before the Sumerian or the Egyptian. We have just begun to dig. We must operate with partial knowledge and be provisionally content with probabilities. In history, as in science and politics, relativity rules, and all formulas should be suspect. History smiles at all attempts to force its flow into theoretical patterns or logical grooves. It plays havoc with our generalizations, breaks all our rules. History is Baroque. Perhaps within these limits, we can learn enough from history to bear reality patiently and to respect one another's delusions. Since man is a moment in astronomic time, a transient guest of the earth, a spore of his species, a scion of his race, a composite of body, character, and mind, a member of a family and a community, a believer or doubter of a faith, a unit in an economy, perhaps a citizen in a state or a soldier in an army, we may ask under the corresponding heads, astronomy, geology, geography, biology, ethnology, psychology, morality, religion, economics, politics, and war, what history has to say about the nature, conduct, and prospects of man. It is a precarious enterprise, and only a fool would try to compress 100 centuries into 100 pages of hazardous conclusions. We proceed. Chapter 2. History and the Earth. Let us define history in its troublesome duplexity as the events or record of the past. Human history is a brief spot in space, and its first lesson is modesty. At any moment a comet may come too close to the Earth and set our little globe turning topsy-turvy in a hectic course, or choke its men and fleas with fumes or heat. Or a fragment of the smiling sun may slip off tangentially, as some think our planet did a few astronomic moments ago, and fall upon us in a wild embrace, ending all grief and pain. We accept these possibilities in our stride, and retort to the cosmos in the words of Pascal, quote, "When the universe has crushed him, man will still be nobler than that which kills him, because he knows that he is dying, and of its victory, the universe knows nothing." End quote. History is subject to geology. Every day the sea encroaches somewhere upon the land, or the land upon the sea. Cities disappear under the water, and sunken cathedrals ring their melancholy bells. Mountains rise and fall in the rhythm of emergence and erosion. Rivers swell and flood or dry up or change their course. Valleys become deserts, and isthmuses become straits. To the geologic eye, all the surface of the earth is a fluid form, and man moves upon it as insecurely as Peter walking on the waves to Christ. Climate no longer controls us as severely as Montesquieu and Buckle supposed, but it limits us. man's ingenuity often overcomes geological handicaps. He can irrigate deserts and air condition the Sahara. He can level or surmount mountains and terrace the hills with vines. He can build a floating city to cross the ocean or gigantic birds to navigate the sky. But a tornado can ruin in an hour the city that took a century to build. An iceberg can overturn or bisect the floating palace and send a thousand merrymakers gurgling to the great certainty. Let rain become too rare, and civilization disappears under sand, as in Central Asia. Let it fall too furiously, and civilization will be choked with jungle, as in Central America. Let the thermal average rise by 20 degrees in our thriving zones, and we should probably relapse into lethargic savagery. In a semi-tropical climate, a nation of 500 million souls may breed like ants, but enervating heat may subject it to repeated conquest by warriors from more stimulating habitats. Generations of men establish a growing mastery over the earth, but they are destined to become fossils in its soil. Geography is the matrix of history, its nourishing mother and disciplining home. Its rivers, lakes, oases, and oceans draw settlers to their shores, for water is the life of organisms and towns and offers inexpensive roads for transport and trade. Egypt was the gift of the Nile, and Mesopotamia built successive civilizations between the rivers and along their effluent canals. India was the daughter of the Indus, the Brahmaputra, and the Ganges. China owed its life and sorrows to the great rivers that, like ourselves, often wandered from their proper beds and fertilized the neighborhood with their overflow. Italy adorned the valleys of the Tiber, the Arno, and the Po. Austria grew along the Danube, Germany along the Elbe and the Rhine, France along the Rhone, the Loire, and the Seine. Petra and Palmyra were nourished by oases in the desert. When the Greeks grew too numerous for their boundaries, they founded colonies along the Mediterranean, like frogs around a pond, said Plato, and along the Euxine or Black Sea. For 2,000 years, from the Battle of Salamis, 480 BC, to the defeat of the Spanish Armada, 1588, the northern and southern shores of the Mediterranean were the rival seats of the white man's ascendancy. But in and after 1492, the voyages of Columbus and Vasco da Gama invited men to brave the oceans. The sovereignty of the Mediterranean was challenged. Genoa, Pisa, Florence, Venice declined. The Renaissance began to fade. The Atlantic nations rose and finally spread their suzerainty over half the world. Westward, the course of empire takes its way, wrote George Berkeley about 1730. Will it continue across the Pacific, exporting European and American industrial and commercial techniques to China, as formerly to Japan? Will Oriental fertility, working with the latest Occidental technology, bring the decline of the West? The development of the airplane will again alter the map of civilization. Trade routes will follow less and less the rivers and seas. Men and goods will be flown more and more directly to their goal. Countries like England and France will lose the commercial advantage of abundant coastlines, conveniently indented. Countries like Russia, China, and Brazil, which were hampered by the excess of their landmass over their coasts, will cancel part of that handicap by taking to the air. Coastal cities will derive less of their wealth from the clumsy business of transferring goods from ship to train or from train to ship. When sea power finally gives place to air power in transport and war, we shall have seen one of the basic revolutions in history. The influence of geographic factors diminishes as technology grows. The character and contour of a terrain may offer opportunities for agriculture, mining, or trade. But only the imagination and initiative of leaders and the hardy industry of followers can transform the possibilities into fact. And only a similar combination, as in Israel today, can make a culture take form over 1,000 natural obstacles. Man not the earth, makes civilization. Chapter 3. Biology and History. History is a fragment of biology. The life of man is a portion of the vicissitudes of organisms on land and sea. Sometimes wandering alone in the woods on a summer day, we hear or see the movement of 100 species of flying, leaping, creeping, crawling, burrowing things. The startled animals scurry away at our coming. The birds scatter, the fish disperse in the brook. Suddenly, we perceive to what a perilous minority we belong on this impartial planet. And for a moment, we feel, as these very denizens clearly do, that we are passing interlopers in their natural habitat. Then, all the chronicles and achievements of man fall humbly into the history and perspective of polymorphous life. All our economic competition, our strife for mates, our hunger and love, and grief and war, are akin to the seeking, mating, striving, and suffering that hide under these fallen trees or leaves, or in the waters, or on the boughs. Therefore, the laws of biology are the fundamental lessons of history. We are subject to the processes and trials of evolution, to the struggle for existence, and the survival of the fittest to survive. If some of us seem to escape the strife or the trials, it is because our group protects us. But the group itself must meet the tests of survival. So, the first biological lesson of history is that life is competition. Competition is not only the life of trade, it is the trade of life. Peaceful when food abounds, violent when the mouths outrun the food. Animals eat one another without qualm. Civilized men consume one another by due process of law. Cooperation is real and increases with social development, but mostly because it is a tool and form of competition. We cooperate in our group, our family, community, club, church, party, race, in quotes, or nation, in order to strengthen our group in its competition with other groups. Competing groups have the qualities of competing individuals: acquisitiveness, pugnacity, partisanship, pride. Our states, being ourselves multiplied, are what we are. They write our natures in bolder type and do our good and evil on an elephantine scale. We are acquisitive, greedy, and pugnacious because our blood remembers millenniums through which our forebears had to chase and fight and kill in order to survive, and had to eat to their gastric capacity for fear they should not soon capture another feast. War is a nation's way of eating. It promotes cooperation because it is the ultimate form of competition. Until our states become members of a large and effectively protective group, they will continue to act like individuals and families in the hunting stage. The second biological lesson of history is that life is selection. In the competition for food or mates or power, some organisms succeed and some fail. In the struggle for existence, some individuals are better equipped than others to meet the tests of survival. Since nature, here meaning total reality and its processes, has not read very carefully the American Declaration of Independence or the French Revolutionary Declaration of the Rights of Man, we are all born unfree and unequal, subject to our physical and psychological heredity, and to the customs and traditions of our group, diversely endowed in health and strength, in mental capacity, and qualities of character. Nature loves difference as the necessary material of selection and evolution. Identical twins differ in 100 ways, and no two peas are alike. Inequality is not only natural and inborn, it grows with the complexity of civilization. Hereditary inequalities breed social and artificial inequalities. Every invention or discovery is made or seized by the exceptional individual and makes the strong stronger, the weak relatively weaker than before. Economic development specializes functions, differentiates abilities, and makes men unequally valuable to their group. If we knew our fellow men thoroughly, we could select 30% of them whose combined ability would equal that of all the rest. Life and history do precisely that, with a sublime injustice reminiscent of Calvin's God. Nature smiles at the union of freedom and equality in our utopias, for freedom and equality are sworn and everlasting enemies, and when one prevails, the other dies. Leave men free, and their natural inequalities will multiply almost geometrically, as in England and America in the 19th century under laissez-faire. To check the growth of inequality, liberty must be sacrificed, as in Russia after 1917. Even when repressed, inequality grows. Only the man who is below the average in economic ability desires equality. Those who are conscious of superior ability desire freedom, and in the end, superior ability has its way. Utopias of equality are biologically doomed, and the best that the amiable philosopher can hope for is an approximate equality of legal justice and educational opportunity. A society in which all potential abilities are allowed to develop and function will have a survival advantage in the competition of groups. This competition becomes more severe as the destruction of distance intensifies the confrontation of states. The third biological lesson of history is that life must breed. Nature has no use for organisms, variations, or groups that cannot reproduce abundantly. She has a passion for quantity as prerequisite to the selection of quality. She likes large litters and relishes the struggle that picks the surviving few. Doubtless she looks on approvingly at the upstream race of 1,000 sperms to fertilize one ovum. She is more interested in the species than in the individual, and makes little difference between civilization and barbarism. She does not care that a high birth rate has usually accompanied a culturally low civilization, and a low birth rate a civilization culturally high. And she, here meaning nature as the process of birth, variation, competition, selection, and survival, sees to it that a nation with a low birth rate shall be periodically chastened by some more virile and fertile group. Gaul survived against the Germans through the help of Roman legions in Caesar's days, and through the help of British and American legions in our time. When Rome fell, the Franks rushed in from Germany and made Gaul France. If England and America should fall, France, whose population remained almost stationary through the 19th century, might again be overrun. If the human brood is too numerous for the food supply, nature has three agents for restoring the balance: famine, pestilence, and war. In a famous essay on population, 1798, Thomas Malthus explained that without these periodic checks, the birth rate would so far exceed the death rate that the multiplication of mouths would nullify any increase in the production of food. Though he was a clergyman and a man of good will, Malthus pointed out that the issuance of relief funds or supplies to the poor encouraged them to marry early and breed improvidently, making the problem worse. In a second edition, 1803, he advised abstention from coitus except for reproduction, but he refused to approve other methods of birth control. Having little hope of acceptance for this counsel of sanctity, he predicted that the balance between mouths and food would be maintained in the future, as in the past, by famine, pestilence, and war. The advances of agricultural and contraceptive technology in the 19th century apparently refuted Malthus. In England, the United States, Germany, and France, the food supply kept pace with births, and the rising standard of living deferred the age of marriage and lowered the size of the family. The multiplication of consumers was also a multiplication of producers. New hands developed new lands to raise more food. The recent spectacle of Canada and the United States exporting millions of bushels of wheat while avoiding famine and pestilence at home seemed to provide a living answer to Malthus. If existing agricultural knowledge were everywhere applied, the planet could feed twice its present population. Malthus would answer, of course, that this solution merely postpones the calamity. There is a limit to the fertility of the soil. Every advance in agricultural technology is sooner or later cancelled by the excess of births over deaths. And meanwhile, medicine, sanitation, and charity nullify selection by keeping the unfit alive to multiply their like. To which hope replies, the advances of industry, urbanization, education, and standards of living in countries that now endanger the world by their fertility will probably have the same effect there in reducing the birth rate as they have had in Europe and North America. Until that equilibrium of production and reproduction comes, it will be a council of humanity to disseminate the knowledge and means of contraception. Ideally, parentage should be a privilege of health, not a byproduct of sexual agitation. Is there any evidence that birth control is dysgenic, that it lowers the intellectual level of the nation practicing it? Presumably, it has been used more by the intelligent than by the simple, and the labors of educators are apparently cancelled in each generation by the fertility of the uninformed. But much of what we call intelligence is the result of individual education, opportunity, and experience, and there is no evidence that such intellectual acquirements are transmitted in the genes. Even the children of PhDs must be educated and go through their adolescent measles of errors, dogmas, and isms. Nor can we say how much potential ability and genius lurk in the chromosomes of the harassed and the handicapped poor. Biologically, physical vitality may be, at birth, of greater value than intellectual pedigree. Nietzsche thought that the best blood in Germany was in peasant veins. Philosophers are not the fittest material from which to breed the race. Family limitation played some part in the history of Greece and Rome. It is amusing to find Julius Caesar offering, 59 BC, rewards to Romans who had many children and forbidding childless women to ride in litters or wear jewelry. Augustus renewed this campaign some 40 years later with like futility. Birth control continued to spread in the upper classes, while immigrant stocks from the Germanic North and the Greek or Semitic East replenished and altered the population of Italy. Very probably this ethnic change reduced the ability or willingness of the inhabitants to resist governmental incompetence and external attack. In the United States, the lower birth rate of the Anglo-Saxons has lessened their economic and political power. And the higher birth rate of Roman Catholic families suggests that by the year 2000, the Roman Catholic Church will be the dominant force in national as well as municipal or state governments. A similar process is helping to restore Catholicism in France, Switzerland, and Germany. The lands of Voltaire, Calvin, and Luther may soon return to the papal fold. So, the birth rate, like war, may determine the fate of theologies, just as the defeat of the Muslims at Tours, 732, kept France and Spain from replacing the Bible with the Quran. So the superior organization, discipline, morality, fidelity, and fertility of Catholics may cancel the Protestant Reformation and the French Enlightenment. There is no humorist like history. Chapter 4, Race and History. There are some 2 billion colored people on the earth, and some 900 million whites. However, many pale faces were delighted when Comte Joseph Arthur de Gobineau, in an essay, 1853-55, announced that the species man is composed of distinct races, inherently different, like individuals in physical structure, mental capacity, and qualities of character, and that one race, the, quote, Aryan, end quote, was by nature superior to all the rest. Quote, everything great, noble, or fruitful in the works of man on this planet, in science, art, and civilization, derives from a single starting point, is the development of a single germ. It belongs to one family alone, the different branches of which have reigned in all the civilized countries of the universe. History shows that all civilization derives from the white race, that none can exist without its help, and that a society is great and brilliant only so far as it preserves the blood of the noble group that created it. End quote.